Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show, Science Facts and Fallacies, episode 232. My name is Cameron English, your host as always, joined again by Dr. Liza Dunn. Liza, what's going on?
Not much. It's been a crazy week. I can't believe it's already Friday.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to the weekend. I get to spend it with my in-laws, which is, it'll be a blast. It'll be a blast. Just kidding. If my in-laws ever see this podcast, I love you guys. You're the best. let's jump right into this. We got a lot to talk about today. We've got our normal three stories. And then we got to say a little bit about this lab leak situation, only because one of our readers brought it up to us after a recent episode we did. So really quick, before we do that, let's go over these stories we're going to talk about. So first up, we have a story called mRNA Technology Revolution, Battling Sickle Cell Aging and Other Tough-to-Tackle Diseases Will Soon Be Easier and Cheaper. Next up, during the COVID pandemic, Republicans in Ohio and Florida had a higher mortality rate than Democrats. And finally, acupuncture pseudoscience. Washington Post propagates alternative medicine. Going to be a fun one there at the very end. However, we're going to say a little bit about this, the origins of COVID. A few weeks ago, some of you may remember, I went on a bit of a tirade. what I consider wagon circling, and you know, there's things that have not been made public that are important to understand how this originated, and I was venting my frustration about that. And one of our dear listeners who was very polite on Twitter, he said, "I'm a loyal listener. I really enjoy the show, but you guys went a little too Joe Rogan on this episode when you were talking about the lab leak," and he pointed to the fact that the consensus position, if you will, is that this was probably a natural spillover event. And then he pointed to, I think it's 3 out of the 5 intelligence agencies, in whatever the specific numbers, the majority of intelligence agencies have said a natural spillover is probably most likely. So I am far from infallible. And so I did a little reflecting and I did a little homework and I just said, okay, was I on solid ground? And with respect to our listener, I think I was. So let me go over a couple things here. And I think, and Liza, of course, you may have your own thoughts on this, so jump in at any point. But the thing that's frustrated me about the lab leak debate, the broader debate as we're having as a culture or a country, whatever you want to call it, is that there's been this sort of insistence that the official scientific respectable position is that this was a natural spillover event. That was at the outset in February, March 2020. That to me seemed like a plausible explanation. Okay, no problem. You know, all the people that study this for a living say this is probably what happened. Okay, fine. Well, October 2021, there was a FOIA request as part of a lawsuit against the National Institutes of Health. And it came out, and this is a headline, this is from Vanity Fair in October of that year. It says, in major shift, NIH admits funding risky virus research in Wuhan. So initially, they had denied funding or having any involvement with the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Of course, this is where the pandemic started, as far as we know. And there's a key point in here that I wanted to stress. So everyone's talked a lot about this fern cleavage site. This genetic element of SARS-CoV-2 that was supposed to make it better at infecting humans. And part of this article stipulates that there was a grant proposal. It was rejected by the federal government, but there was a grant proposal to insert a fern cleavage site into SARS coronaviruses, bat coronaviruses. And I thought, oh, you know, how interesting is that, you know? And I'll return to this gentleman in a minute, but Jamie Metzl, he's a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. It's a very widely respected think tank, advises governments on all kinds of policy issues. And the way he described this, he says, if I applied for funding to paint Central Park purple and was denied, but then a year later we woke up to find Central Park painted purple, I'd be a prime suspect, you know? So this comes out, right? We start to learn a little bit more about the research that's going on in this institute. We find out that our federal government is actually funding not just work at that lab, but the kind of work that could have led to this pandemic. And still, the official respected scientific position is that this was a natural spillover. Okay, all right, fine. So let's keep going here. So in July, just a little over a month ago, we saw all of these Slack chats and these emails come out from the authors of what's colloquially called the Proximal Origins paper that came out in March 2020. And this was the very vigorous scholarly defense of the spillover, or the animal to human jump, right? The Wuhan market, or, you know, origin of the virus. And I'm not going to read all of these, but there's some very frank discussions about the fact that a lab leak is highly possible or probable, whatever, likely, whatever term you want to use. And then there's discussion about how they're going to turn the media, specifically a reporter from the New York Times, away from a lab origin because we don't know one way or the other. And there would be serious political fallout in China and for, you know, the scientific establishment. And so for what seemed like political reasons or professional reasons, they're going to steer away from this. So let me read this quote. This is from Christian Anderson. This has been all over social media. This is not a revelation. On February 1st of 2020, he said, "I think the main thing still in my mind is that the lab escape version of this is so friggin' likely to happen because they were already doing this type of work and the molecular data is fully consistent with that scenario." All right. So maybe he's changed his mind. Maybe there's some evidence I'm not aware of. But as he and his co-authors were preparing the paper that was dismissing a lab leak, they were saying this is friggin' likely. His words, not mine, okay? And still, the official respected scientific position is that a natural spillover is the most likely hypothesis. Okay, so I'm done. I'm not trying to belabor this. But final thing from Jamie Metzl. This is on Twitter. This is from July 20th, so just last month. He says, "There can be no doubt the proximal origin authors consciously and inappropriately downplayed the COVID-19 research-related origin hypothesis and coordinated efforts manipulating media coverage. They also interacted like noxious frat boys because they insult their colleagues and they're just kind of rude." I mean, everyone does that at times. That's not unique, but he just threw that on as a final thing. So before we get into our stories, all I'm saying here is, and I said this a few weeks ago, we don't know for sure what happened. We probably won't, because we know the Chinese government has withheld lab records, and I believe they've actually destroyed viral samples because they don't want this pinned on them. So in other words, there's a lot of things that point to this as a likely explanation, but the information you would need to determine it is not available. So, and with no disrespect to our listener, I find it a little convenient that people are saying, well, all the evidence points to a natural origin. I'm like, well, you don't, you know, it's like, if you're going to set your foot on the scale, don't try to tell me that you know how much I weigh, because right, the deck is stacked, is what I'm saying. So I'll stop. If you have anything to add, Liza, jump on in. But that's where my thinking is.
I just think that you know, I don't think that we will know. The horse is out of the barn. You know, and I think spending all sorts of time pointing fingers, it makes it difficult. But not being able to discuss it raises doubt in people's minds about what they can and can't believe. And so I think that the fact that there wasn't an open, transparent discussion about the possibility of this being a reality from the get-go, when the outbreak was in Wuhan, and there just coincidentally was a lab there, and normal people would think that should be entertained as a possibility. Now, I'm not saying this was a purposeful leak. I'm not saying that it may have been an accident. It may have had an animal origin. At this point, I think that the discussion around it has gotten so heated that it's unfortunate, but it's sown a lot of distrust. At this point, the horse is out of the barn. And I think we need to get much more focused on treating and managing this disease, which has now become endemic. It's just going to be part of our everyday lives. But it does give you an idea that why people distrust the messaging coming from our public health organizations. And that's really unfortunate, because some really important good information comes from those agencies too. And we need to figure out how to rebuild that trust.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And I may not sound serious about this, but it doesn't bother me. Like, I'm not going to lose sleep if it's conclusively shown that this came from an animal. Again, there's no conclusive evidence that that happened, but if it does show up one day, it's like, okay, you know, I'm going to go take my son to the park and go on with my life.
That's great.
But most of my commentary about the pandemic has been about that aspect, the science communication aspect, and my concern that people have just lost all trust. And I can't blame them, frankly, for some of the foolishness that's gone on. So that's what I was focused on. That was what I had in mind when we were talking about that. So I hope that addresses the concerns. We can bring this up again if someone has more questions. But enough of that. Let's jump into these stories. This first one is super exciting. It's rare that we get to talk about, you know, great things happening. It's usually bad news or a bad study or a bad media report. This is really good. So this one's called mRNA Technology Revolution. Battling sickle cell aging and other tough to tackle diseases will soon be easier and cheaper. I'm going to rely on Liza to do the heavy lifting with the molecular biology here, but let me try to briefly introduce this. So this is by Michael LePage, writing for The New Scientist. And he begins by pointing out that the mRNA technology that enabled some of the COVID shots can be repurposed to use gene editing to correct mutations in cells that are all throughout our bodies and cause all kinds of serious diseases. So he's talking here about inherited blood disorders, HIV, and I'm a little skeptical of this one, but apparently at some point you could use this technology to reverse aging or slow aging or something. That remains to be seen.
Of youth is always the goal.
yes, right. Yeah, live forever. I don't know why anyone would want to do that. I'm happy with one career and one family, one life. Anyways. There is a lot of potential here to do a lot of good in terms of public health. One of the researchers involved named Stefano Ravella at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia says, this is the future of medicine. The sky's the limit, which is really cool. So just to briefly refresh from last week, and Liza went into this in great detail, but messenger RNAs, they carry the instructions for building proteins, including the enzymes that enable CRISPR gene editing. So using this messenger RNA, they can give you an injection, and it doesn't go intramuscularly, it goes into your bloodstream, and then they can target the defective cells, and these molecules go in and correct the mutations, which is incredible. I mean, just the fact that that's possible and that we figured out how to do it is amazing. Now, there are some treatments for some of these conditions, like beta thalassemia is one of them. It's one of these blood disorders, but it's really invasive because they have to take your blood stem cells out of your bone marrow, extract them out of your body, edit them in the lab, and then infuse them back into your bone marrow. And in order to do that, they have to give you very toxic drugs that kill some of your existing blood stem cells, I believe. And this is so severe, it can actually make people sterile in some cases. So the incredible solution here, as best I can understand it, is that you can use messenger RNA to target some of these cells and kill them. You can induce what's called apoptosis. It's just a fancy, sexy word for suicide. You can tell these cells, you can instruct them to commit suicide. That's a whole nother topic that I find really cool anyway. But in other words, you can replicate this treatment, but it's entirely in vivo in the body. So it's much less invasive. It's much less expensive. It's much less time consuming. And so, you know, if you can do this at scale with however many thousands of people have these different diseases, and with HIV, it's in the millions, I'm sure. Yeah, I mean, this is potentially revolutionary. And so this is really cool. I think I got the broad outlines of it, but please dive in here and elaborate.
Yeah. So this is very cool. Now I'm going to give you a caveat. This is done in mice and then some human cells. It's not ready for prime time yet, but people who've got what we call hemoglobinopathies. Hemoglobinopathies are, hemoglobin is the molecule in your red blood cells that carries oxygen. And people can inherit defects in the way their hemoglobin works. And so that can result in things like sickle cell anemia or beta thalassemia. And those diseases usually affect people who came originally from regions that had a lot of malaria. And if you have one gene from your mom or dad that's normal and one gene from your mom or dad that's abnormal, you are what we call a heterozygote. And so your red blood cells are a little bit more fragile and they are more resistant to malaria. So, but if you have two abnormal genes, remember the genes are the recipes for proteins. Genes are on DNA. DNA is like a cookbook that has a whole bunch of genes, which are recipes for proteins. If you get proteins that are abnormal from each parent, you will wind up having full-blown disease. So sickle cell disease as opposed to just sickle cell trait. So sickle cell trait is protective against diseases like malaria, and sickle cell disease actually can make you sick because the cells, when you're in low oxygen or in periods of stress, actually turn into, instead of nice little round cells that float around and carry oxygen, they turn into sickle shaped and they plug up all the small little arteries in veins in your microvasculature. And that can cause incredible pain crises. It can cause that part, but what we call micro infarcts, where parts of your, those little parts get no oxygen or nutrients. They can die. So people can get very, very sick. And people, if they can have strokes, they can have a whole variety of different illnesses. And it's a very hard disease to treat because it presents with acute pain crisis, which are really often have to be given high doses of opiates and everything that goes along with that. So there's been a real desire to try to figure out some way to fix this. And there's been a lot of hope for gene therapy to do that, but with not much success. Now, that's until relatively recently when with the discovery of a thing called CRISPR, where you can basically target the abnormal amino acid, which is like one part of the recipe that to make the protein that's making it abnormal. You can target it and you can cut it out and replace it. So it's like a find and replace program that you can do. And if you can do that to all of your cells, that's what CRISPR-Cas9 and a couple of other different gene editing therapies theoretically can do, is find the abnormal amino acid, cut it out and replace it with the normal one, and then all of a sudden you've got normal cells. And so there was a lot of excitement, but how on earth do you ever get this delivered, right, to your cells? And how do you get, if you've got these cells floating around, you know, those cells are already out. So how do you get it early enough to the place where the cells are being made? So the baby cells that are being made in your bone marrow actually are corrected before they ever get into the circulatory system and things like that. So and around the body. So you're going to have a hard time doing it with cells that are already in circulation because there's so many of them. But if you can correct it at the stage where the cells are being produced early, then that's where you want to get in. And so I'm hoping that this makes sense because this is kind of really nuanced molecular biology. It's very cool. So what they realized, so how do you deliver this CRISPR-Cas9 enzyme or how do you deliver these gene editing enzymes and things like that? Well, they realized because of the mRNA technology, because of the COVID vaccine, is you could use these lipid nanoparticles as envelopes and you can inject them into the bloodstream and then start delivering the enzyme. Now, when you get it into the bloodstream, the question is, the lipid nanoparticle protects it, right? So it doesn't necessarily get broken down. But how do you get it to go to the place that you want it to go? How does it just not go all over the body? Well, it turns out that you can put an antibody on the lipid nanoparticle, which will direct it to the right place in the body. And in this case, that's the bone marrow. And the bone marrow is the factory for your blood, your red and white blood cells. And so once it gets directed to the bone marrow, it will bind to the exact right spot where these particular cells are being made and then deliver that enzyme to fix that defect in the stem cells. Now, these are different than embryonic stem cells. These are your bone marrow stem cells that are naturally occurring, and they're part of your everyday life. So this is not like taking an embryo and doing it to transplant kind of thing. This is dealing with your own endogenous stem cells that you use to make your red blood cells all the time, or all your blood cells all the time. So, normally in the state of affairs, when people have hemoglobinopathies or diseases of their red blood cells, if you wanted to fix that problem, you would do a stem cell transplant, right? And that would involve irradiating or giving chemotherapy to knock out the bone marrow, right? Because you would take the cells, genetically program them outside of the body, and then knock out the bone marrow so you can replace the cells with normal cells, and then grow them back, and then hopefully your cells will produce things like that. Now, the problem is, the reason why we don't typically do that with diseases like hemoglobinemia, with sickle cell anemia, or that beta thalassemia, is there's a very, very hot, that's a very, very high risk procedure to do, is to knock out the bone marrow and do a bone marrow transplant. And the reason why is because if you knock out the bone marrow, you can have a couple of things. First of all, you become profoundly immunosuppressed. So you're very susceptible to a whole bunch of infections because you don't make white blood cells that fight infections. You can get very, very short of breath because you're not making any red blood cells, and that they carry oxygen, so that can damage your body. And then you can also have bleeding complications because you also make your platelets, which plug up all the little holes. So bone marrow transplant is a huge deal. And a lot of people don't think that the risks of bone marrow transplant outweigh the benefits of fixing these particular diseases. And so the other problem that you can get is, if you don't have an exact match when you're doing a bone marrow transplant, is you can get what we call graft versus host disease, where that your body, your cells that you've transplanted in maybe another person's cells that are close match, if they don't quite match, then they will think your T cells and B cells and your white blood cells, your neutrophils, will think that you are foreign. And they will make an autoimmune response to you called graft versus host disease, and that is a devastating complication of bone marrow transplant. So generally speaking, we have not treated sickle cell anemia and other non-malignant diseases of the marrow with this kind of treatment because of the risks associated with bone marrow transplant and irradiation and things like that. So what they did to deal with that is also interesting. They delivered a gene that actually causes programmed cell death, and it turns off a molecular switch that keeps the cells alive, and so you can deliver that and actually wind up targeting the stem cells with the same kind of antibodies, turn it off, and then you don't have to do irradiation, you don't have to use chemotherapy, you don't have to worry quite as much that you may get some immunosuppression, but it's a much more benign way to decrease the number of cells in the bone marrow, so you can replace that bone marrow with the functioning cells. So that's a little bit of a long route to how we got here, but I hope that clarifies. It's very exciting for people who have this very debilitating chronic long-term illnesses and premature, a lot of mortality associated with the two.
It's incredible. And thank you for clarifying. I should have said at the top that this is the study that this is based on. It's proof of concept. It's been done in animals. So they've shown that it works, but there are some other related, just a handful, but there's a few other similar treatments. They're not quite the same, but there's one. We interviewed a researcher a couple years ago on the show from, I believe, Oregon State University, And they're now injecting the instructions for CRISPR into people's eyeballs, people who are blind from birth. And they correct the mutation that causes, it's a very specific type of blindness. And it works. And it's in clinical trials. So they're doing it in people. I don't think it's been approved by the FDA yet. But I mean, the potential here is enormous. I mean, you're curing blindness, right? I remember I had a...
which is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. I had an eye doctor who was, I was talking about this with him. I was getting an eye exam or something. And he said, you know, 50 years ago, if somebody was going blind, it was like, well, learn how to read Braille, you know, and now people that are born blind, we go, oh, there's a thing for that. You know, you just, right. Yeah. It's incredible.
And so this is why also, this stuff is very exciting stuff. And this is why it's so important not to, back again to the mRNA vaccines, that this is the potential that this technology has. It's really to improve the lives of people who have had suffered incredible morbidity and mortality. So I think that, wow, it's incredibly interesting science. And I hope we can kind of not have it go the way of GMOs.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. And this is the kind of stuff, this personalized medicine, personalized biomedicine, this is what really intrigued me about all the biotechnology stuff years ago when I first started hearing about it, is that, you know, you can target specific genes and, you know, there's all these cool enzymes that do very specific things and we can use them to grow more food and to cure disease. It's just so exciting, you know? And so that's one reason why a lot of the discussions around the vaccines are really troubling to me, you know, because you have the silly folks like Steve Kirsch, and then you have, you know, people who are trying to censor discussions about the vaccines and so forth. Like on both sides, you have people that are putting this in jeopardy in real ways, because even if this works, if you can't get people to use it, it doesn't matter, you know? So I think that's one reason that
one,
we focus on that.
Or so if a company... Yeah, and if companies think that it's gonna they're gonna wind up with, you know, multi-billion-dollar lawsuits because of this, they just won't take it. They just won't go further.
Yes, absolutely. It's a very good point. I feel like we could keep talking about this, but we should move on just so we don't get too bogged down. Well, I think we need to come back to this more, because there's CAR T therapy. There's all kinds of cool things where you can use people's genetics to target whatever it is that threatens their health. It's incredible stuff. Anyways, with that lovely story out of the way, let's go back to some insanity. So this is a story by my friend and colleague, Dr. Chuck Dinnerstein from the American Council on Science and Health. I host another podcast with Chuck called Science Dispatch, full disclosure. But he is here. He's talking about a study that was just published in JAMA Internal Medicine. This is an epidemiological study. And as the title of the article suggests, they're looking at excess mortality during the pandemic, just in Florida and Ohio, between Republicans and Democrats. So this is the question that they pose. This is at the top of the study, if you read it. This is what they said. Was political party affiliation a risk factor associated with excess mortality during the COVID-19 pandemic? Okay, we'll talk about the question in a minute, but their conclusion was, after looking at, it's a little over 530,000 deaths, and these are individuals 25 to 65 or 75. This is a pretty wide age group between March 2020 and December 2021. And so they found that once the vaccines were authorized for use, there were more Republicans in these two states who died and I believe who also were vaccinated at a lower rate. So before we get into the nitty gritty details, here's their takeaway, the authors of the study. They say the differences in excess mortality by political party suggest that differences in vaccination attitudes and reported uptake between Republicans and Democratic voters may have been a factor in the severity and trajectory of the pandemic in the U.S. Okay, there's a lot of the, you know, reading deep into this paper in the discussion section, or the come to Jesus section, as I say, there's a lot more here, but what was your take on this, Dr. Dunn?
This is Steve Kirsch level epidemia. And I cannot believe it was published in the Journal of American Medical. Because if I have been in spaces and listened to Steve Kirsch, and all he talks about is excess deaths being related to vaccination and excess mortality, this and that and the other. And it is absolutely the number one. Our goal should be to provide the best health care to as many people as possible and build trust in this vaccine. And it's because it's efficacious, right? And what this does is it divides people along political lines. It does exactly what we've been saying doctors should not be doing by making people feel like their political affiliation has nothing to do with, you know, public health, right? And one, so there's so many problems with this. The sentence that got me the most in this article was this. The differences for the age group 25 to 64 years were not significant. And then Democratic voters had a significantly higher excess death rates compared to Republican voters for the age groups 65 to 74 years. So somehow now, with if you torture the data enough to confess, you can sort of squeeze in there that maybe the state leans Republican, and it's actually only in Ohio that this finding was there, and it's buried in all sorts of tables and stuff that you have to get into. So I'm not sure that, I think they're emphasizing one aspect of this and not the other. So I have a real problem with this study. I'm really disappointed in JAMA for publishing it. If anything, it's an association. There's no evidence of causality. We don't know what the underlying health effects, situation was with these people. Were they obese? Did they smoke? This was also right when the Delta variant took off. As far as I know, voter rolls don't say what, even though they'll say somebody's Republican or Democrat, they won't have vaccination status of those individuals in there. So we don't know what the vaccination status of those individual Republicans were. We don't know what they died of, excess mortality. Yes. If they got hit by buses, then that would be not related to the vaccine. So what this kind of article does is further politicizes the discussion and drives people away from real meaningful engagement with scientific topics. And I think it's extraordinarily unfortunate that this got published. So not to mention the fact that Operation Warp Speed was started under Donald Trump, and whether you like him or not, it was a successful program, right? And the people, there is video footage of the whole Democratic side talking about taking these vaccines because they weren't studied well enough. All of the talking points that you're hearing from the right now came originally from the left. So, right. This is a bipartisan, vaccine hesitancy is a bipartisan problem. It actually started out, there are places in California. I think if you took this to California, you might find that there were a lot more left-leaning people that were anti-vaccine than there are right. Who's heading that all up? The candidate for the Democratic nomination, RFK Jr. So as far as I know, the Kennedys are not Republicans, and they have been fostering this kind of distrust for a very, very long time. So this kind of thing is very divisive, and it's not rooted in scientific inquiry. It's an association rather than, you can't even make the claim that it's causal. And they are using the same arguments. They're saying, don't trust Steve Kirsch because his epidemiology is all messed up. This is exactly what they're doing.
I remember. Trust us. Yeah. It was several months ago, but he tweeted something about Steve Kirsch. He's a useful foil for us. he tweeted something about, you know, after the vaccines came out, excess mortality increased. So how could the vaccines have done anything useful? And you retweeted him. You said, hey, genius, you don't know how those people died and whether or not they got the vaccine. And I remember everyone was high-fiving you and they're like, yeah, go get them. And you were absolutely correct. But I think this is the same fallacy in the study, right? So, and I, you mentioned
this is the same thing.
Yeah.
But these are doctors. They should know better.
Yeah. Yeah. And let's emphasize, you mentioned this, both of these, but this is county level data. So they don't know who got vaccinated and who died, right? So these are, you're already sort of removed from where you need to be. And then, as you also said, you don't know how these people died. So, right, it could have been, as the study indicates, that fewer Republicans got vaccinated, but then more of them got hit by cars or had heart attacks, or, you know, they got eaten by a shark. You don't, I mean, that's unlikely in Ohio, but you know what I'm saying? you just don't know, right? That's all.
But why the focus on Republicans when they say in their own words, Democratic voters had a significantly higher excess death rates compared with Republican voters for the at-risk age group, 65 to 74 years old. The median, I think if I remember correctly, looking at one of these tables, the median age of death was 78. That's normal life expectancy.
Right.
So how do we know that these people didn't die of, you know, natural causes that weren't COVID related? Well, you know, excess deaths, I think a lot of it was COVID. But my goodness, it's the second thing is, I don't know if you remember how the vaccines got rolled out, but there were lots of counties that didn't have access to the actual vaccines. You had permission to get the vaccines. Everybody was granted, but it was very spotty as to where those vaccines were available. So if you were in a rural community, you would have a harder time getting your hands on those vaccines than you would if you were at a tertiary care center where everybody was, you know, doing these mass vaccination campaigns. So there are all sorts of things that could have gone into this. And I'm very disappointed in JAMA for making this a political issue.
Yeah, there's a movie from 1992. It's called Mr. Baseball. It's still one of my favorites. If you haven't seen it, it's Tom Selleck. He plays a Major League Baseball player, but he's on the tail end of his career and he's starting to suck. And so his manager pulls him aside and he says, you know, Tom, or his name's not Tom in the movie, but he says, you batted 235 last season. And he responds, last season, I led this team in ninth inning doubles in the month of August, right? So like, in other words, in order to defend himself, he has to go to this very, very specific statistic and he has to control for every possible variable that you could say, well, okay, that is just so useless to us as a team, right? And you see this a lot with this risk factor epidemiology that we talk about. It's like, climate change causes heart attacks. It's like, yeah, well, if you exclude the fact that people eat too much and they have heart disease and they smoke, and well, yeah, in that case, you know, climate change. Right. It's that kind of thing. I see that a lot. And here's something else I want to add before we move on. I wrote an article last year for ACSH called Fact Checking ABC News' State by State COVID Comparisons. I encourage everyone to read this because what drove me nuts throughout the pandemic is you would have California or people in the media say, California is just doing so great right now because they have mask mandates and they have lockdowns and they're really following the advice of the CDC. They're just nailing it, you know? And then at a different period in the pandemic, California was doing very, very poorly. And you could look at Florida, which had none of those things for most of the pandemic, and say, well, Florida's doing great and their population's older. So, I mean, maybe this whole thing is a hoax. Like, there's no COVID. It's phony because Florida's doing good, right? And people made that argument. You had people in the DeSantis administration not saying it was a hoax, but saying, look, obviously we know what we're doing because you guys, you know, more of your population is dying from COVID. And then when it flipped, or excuse me, the response from people on the, I don't know, the pro-California side was that, well, you know, we have greater population density and we have more poverty and blah, blah, blah. Like any sort of variable that you could throw in there to excuse why the state was doing poorly was brought up. And then when it flipped, when California, at a different point, California is doing better, all of a sudden, right, population density, poverty, none of this stuff, obesity, none of this was a match for the brave leadership of our governor, Gavin Newsom, who I've mentioned before, I just can't stand, right? So in other words, the point of my article and the point that people have made broadly is that you can make any kind of association you want, right? You just pick, and frankly, the CDC did this with some of their masking studies, which drove me bananas, right? They would just pick two counties and they would pick a period of time, and then they would run a model and they go, well, this county had more masking and, you know, they had fewer infections for 3.5 weeks in, you know, September 2021 or whatever. And so all that to say, it's just ridiculous. You know, it's like you, and again, you said this when you were pointing Steve Kirsch, it's like, you can't employ the same sloppy methodology that you malign as misinformation when other people do it. It's just not okay.
That's exactly right. Because it's pure propaganda from both sides. When you're picking and that's cherry picking and propagandizing on, and this it applies to both sides. And once again, I think the most destructive thing that's happened with the COVID pandemic is that people started pointing at each other and talking about whatever affiliations they had politically shaped every single other aspect of their lives. And so there's a profound distrust between people, neighbors, families. How destructive could this possibly be? I mean, it's really, really terrible. And to see physicians participating in this level of denigration is really frustrating. Anyway.
It is. Yeah. And I'm right there with you. You know, when I wrote that story, I had a few people in the comments say, you know, you're a partisan hack and you've got an axe to grind. I was like, well, no, not really. You know, I didn't say anything political. I just pointed out that these matchups that are all over the headlines are very clearly designed to promote a particular perspective on this. And you just simply throw out any piece of data that isn't convenient to that narrative. And that's ridiculous. You know, it's like, and it's, I harp on this so much because it's very clear to me that there's a lot of people in science media and in academia who aren't interested in, you know, having a big tent. They want to say, my side's smarter than your side. And if you don't agree with us, you're more likely to die. It's like, that's not helpful research. That does not protect public health. It's just a waste of everyone's time and money, frankly.
It should be a pursuit of the truth. Wherever this truth takes you is that should be the goal.
Okay. Well said. Good summary. Let's move on to this last story. This is called Acupuncture Pseudoscience. Washington Post propagates alternative medicine. This is originally by Dr. Stephen Novella at Science Based Medicine. And he's a neuroscientist by training, I think, but he's a great writer, great science communicator on most things. I'm not going to nitpick, but he's pretty good on most things. So he points out there's been this, he says it's a fascinating and frustrating cultural shift towards or on perspectives towards acupuncture. You know, so in the last 20 years or so, it's for whatever reason, it's garnered mainstream acceptability. You have major newspapers like the Post, even some physicians saying this is a great alternative treatment and you should try it for pain or whatever, you know, whatever ails you. It's one of those kind of things. And he points to this Post article. This is actually by a physician. I'm not familiar with this person, but her name is Tricia Pasricha, I believe is how you pronounce it. But she's writing this op-ed and she's making the case for acupuncture as this reasonable treatment. And Novella says this illustrates nicely how you employ misinformation, how you use sources selectively, and how even professionals reach the wrong conclusions when they're not careful with the data that they're utilizing. And one of the points he makes, there's lots we could get into, but one of the points he makes is that she quotes, and this is a common mistake I see a lot of people make, she quotes outdated research. So she quoted a systematic review, which is just you gather all of the research on a topic from, you know, one point in time to another point, and you say, this is what all of the evidence shows. And she says, there was a meta-analysis, I think it was from 2018. She says, this showed there was a statistically significant improvement in patients who got acupuncture versus a control group. So they got nothing or they got fake acupuncture. And Novella points out, he said, well, you know, that's fine, but there was an actual bigger meta-analysis and systematic review that incorporated the one she cites. And that one, he points out, found nothing. and I think the specific quote is, there is insufficient clinical evidence in support of acupuncture. And he goes on, and you can get into this, he talks about how a lot of these studies can't be combined because, you know, acupuncture isn't, it's not like, like heart surgery, where it's like, when you go get a certain kind of heart surgery, they do X, Y, Z steps, right? When you go get acupuncture, one practitioner might do it very differently. And I guess, I forget what they're called, but the points where you insert the needles are different, right? So they might poke you at different parts of your body. So it's hard to combine these studies because you're not necessarily reviewing the same procedure. And another point he makes is that, and this is so funny, right? This should destroy this whole thing immediately, as he says, the benefit of acupuncture tended to increase or decrease based on what was happening to the control group. So if you had people, you had controls that were getting some other kind of treatment or were improving independent of this phony acupuncture they were getting, that tended to make acupuncture look better, right? So in other words, before I stop talking, this body of research is just a mess. There's just nothing really good here. There's lots of noise and very little signal, I think, is what Novella says. So I'll stop. Your thoughts?
Yes. And what Novella says is inconclusive, maybe Novella or maybe somebody else. But this is a quote directly from, that might be this article, or it might be David Gorski. So double check me. But inconclusive literature plus no plausible physiologic mechanism for acupuncture to work an equal ineffective treatment whose effects are non-specific placebo. So a lot of people think that the reason why people think that acupuncture works is because they have a placebo effect. You're doing something, you feel like you've got that, gives you some sense of control. When you've got some sense of control, it kind of settles your stress response, and then which naturally kind of makes you feel better. So placebo is a real thing, the placebo effect. A lot of people feel better when they have some kind of intervention because of the physiologic response to having some kind of intervention. So But the placebo effect does not mean that something is efficacious. And so, for example, if you have back pain, most back pain gets better on its own within a 6-week period. So if you just happen to have acupuncture, 5 weeks into it, and the 6 week, you're better. Oh, wow. That's great. But it may not be the acupuncture. And then once again, if you're comparing it to a control group who's not taking anything, and they're going to have a sense of pain, or a control group that is taking a Tylenol, which may have helped the pain a little bit, but doesn't have an anti-inflammatory effects, versus somebody who's taking like an ibuprofen, which is going to have anti-inflammatory effects, and that's going to probably improve your back pain more, versus an opioid if you've got like full-blown sciatica. So if you've got somebody with sciatica who gets acupuncture versus getting anti-inflammatories, the anti-inflammatory side is going to do better. And you can do study and study and study and study after this. And if you mix up all these studies, it's the whole idea of garbage in and garbage out. If you've got a bunch of junk studies that you're doing a systematic review on, you're going to get a bunch of garbage on the back end. So it's unfortunately, it's really not much more than a placebo effect. Now, what bothers me about this, and I'll confess, for a while, so when I was an academic, I taught a class called Medicine East and West, and we talked about the different medical systems in different countries, and China was one of them. And we talked about traditional Chinese medicine and learned a little bit about that and talked about acupuncture then. I would superficially glance at these studies and says, hey, this seems to have some kind of effect. But once you dive into it a little bit more, you realize maybe not. And so it's very easy to get sidetracked by what appears to be a very good, well-designed study overall, a systematic review, until you start digging into the data that's underneath it. This is incidentally what the problem with AI is, is that it could amplify that, right? And, ChatGPT and things like that could really amplify systematic reviews that are not well done and spout them as truth. And this is one of the risks of that. But we started getting into this stuff in medicine, I think was as physicians have gotten busier and busier doing clerical work, and patients are getting very annoyed because physicians have their backs to them and are on the computer all the time and not looking at them anymore, we lost our propensity to be good, bedside clinicians, where you sat and you had conversations with the patient and you looked at the patient. That we've lost that, the art of medicine. And as that evolved, right, more and more, there was more and more of a push for people to pursue other ways of having other people listen to them. So it opened a big avenue for alternative medicine. And alternative medicine was made relatively mainstream when the NIH opened the National Center for Complementary and Integrative Health. And so mainstream medicine's given this a boost. These people have come to medical schools. They're in medical curricula. They, you know, there are, you know, whole departments and whole divisions of, you know, these alternative medicine programs in medical schools that have embedded themselves in medical schools. And what makes it even worse is that a lot of them have gotten money from anti-vaccine organizations. And so you've fought like, I mean, U.S. Right to Know goes and goes and has access to major medical schools and sends their speakers to major medical schools and talks about, you know, all these alternative, the Organic Consumers Association, those they get funding from anti-vaccine organizations. And so how did we get to people not trusting evidence-based medicine, which we have for decades have really tried to promote? Well, we've opened the door, and this is a Trojan horse, and it has undermined the practice of my profession, and it's undermined people's faith in it, in true, well-researched good medicine. And that's why you're seeing this whole kind of blossoming of the anti-vaccine movement. You've got people who are, you know, giving, you know, inhalational hydrogen peroxide to treat COVID. You've got, you know, cardiologists promoting the use of natokinase. You can buy a over-the-counter thrombolytic that's going to dissolve spike protein. And we, our institute, National Institute of Health, supported by taxpayer dollars, has funded this kind of nonsense. You know, you've got guys who, you know, are on full faculty at medical schools who have papers on how they've communicated with the dead. They're full professors, or they can levitate. So how's an ordinary person supposed to be able to tease out the what's right and wrong when and we've lost credibility, and I'm really mourn for my profession.
There's a book. It's old now. It's called Science Left Behind. It's from 2010. It's by two of my good friends, Dr. Alex Barrazzo and Hank Campbell, who founded Science 2.0. And in this book, they're talking about that, you know, that federal agency. They said at one point they funded a study into the psychological benefits of practicing the Jedi religion from Star Wars. And so I have to go look up the details. I haven't read this for years, but their only commentary on that was hard to justify the study is because it's just, it's absurd. You know, it's really funny. And to add on to that, Novella doesn't get into this, but the obvious implication of this is that you have these newspapers like the Washington Post and the New York Times, like major reputable news outlets that are endorsing this garbage. You know, there was Nicholas Kristof at the New York Times years ago said, you won't touch receipt paper because it has bisphenol A in it. And that's an endocrine disruptor. It's like, you're such an idiot, dude. Like, why would you put that in an article that millions of people are going to read? But the overarching point before I stop talking is that these newspapers take it upon themselves to fact check other people and to combat misinformation. And then they stand on the sidelines with pom-poms and they cheerlead the federal government as they censor their political opponents through social media companies. And then they turn around with not a hint of shame. And then they publish this kind of garbage. You know, it's like you can't expect people to trust what you say about a vaccine when you're going to, you know, give a platform to Stephanie Seneff, who thinks that glyphosate caused COVID and, you know, acupuncture. It's just,
that's exactly right. And there are lots of people. Yeah. I mean, a lot, there are people who are making literally charging thousands of dollars for outpatient COVID treatments that are have not shown benefit in clinical trials. We and these are well-designed clinical trials, and there are people who are making tons and tons of money off of wellness. The wellness industry is a multi-trillion dollar industry, right? People who have done, scientists who have done the work and have demonstrated over and over again that you know, this pharmaceutical is really important for treating this, that pharmaceutical companies get tagged. They're not trusted at all, but we will trust, you know, this person off the street to who's also making all sorts of money to selling products. We're going to test that. We're going to trust that product, even though it hasn't been through a double-blind, randomized, controlled study. You know, and how do you even do that with acupuncture? You know, you poke them in different spots, right? I mean, the whole point about acupuncture is it's basically astrology, where you know, the little acupoints are related to, you know, where the constellations are in the sky, and that's going to fix your meridians and your, I think it's chi, which is some energy, and there's no science there.
Yeah, it's really nuts. It's an unrelated example, but a lot of it is that pop culture does this too, right? So you have the newspapers, but like you have Netflix and you have Hulu. I wrote an article earlier this week about this show on Netflix called Painkiller, which is all about the opioid epidemic. And it is cartoonishly stupid. They blamed it all on opioids, which for reasons we can get into another time, is just nuts. It's just absolutely ridiculous. And you have these narratives. They're coming from people who are playing doctors on TV. That's another thing we could talk about sometime, right? You have very convincing actors and actresses wearing white coats telling the general public this. And so one thing that people suck at, all of us, is we remember information that we've heard, but we're not good at remembering the source, right? So you might mix up that you heard something, some piece of medical information from an idiot on Grey's Anatomy who has no medical training. And you might say, oh yeah, my doctor told me that, because you mix those things up. So again, not to get off on a rabbit trail, but you have pop culture, you have newspapers, you have magazines, you have medical journals, as we just established with JAMA Internal Medicine, right? You have all of these ostensibly upstanding sources feeding people lies. And, you know, get your friends to listen to this podcast is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and the nice thing about this podcast, and the nice thing about, I think, this genetic literacy project is that you may not hear things that you necessarily want to hear, but we're going to go for try to tell the truth, right? And try to just keep to the truth and try not to get off on these political rants. I think it's such an important thing. The truth is not always pretty, but it's truth. So, and if there's a mistake, we are open to being corrected. So that's the goal.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's clear that at this point, we're not here to win friends and influence people, because if we were, we would take a different tack. But really, you know, I mean,
Joe Rogan.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. You know, and some of the things we get into, they are necessarily political because they have to do with public health and public policy. And sometimes it's because the studies you're reviewing are openly partisan, you know? So, but we do try to keep keep it like, you know, here's the evidence, right? And so someone challenged me on the lab leak. So I said, well, let me go look and here's what I came, you know what I mean? So we are very much open to correction. And I hope people get some benefit out of this, because, you know, I try to ask you questions that I would have if I was just a guy on the street, you know, looking into this stuff. So I do hope that helps.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll leave it there. We went a little bit long today. So thank you all for sticking with us and listening or watching the show. We'll be back next time for 233. Follow us on social media at Dr. Liza MD, at Cam J English, at Genetic Literacy for the Genetic Literacy Project. Go to their website. It's just geneticliteracyproject.org. Read their content. And with that, we will see you all next time.
Bye-bye. Have a good weekend.